To set the world on a pathway of net zero carbon emissions, electrification of the transport sector plays a pivotal role. Along with reducing the carbon footprint of transport, there's a growing interest in inclusive and sustainable mobility, which provides access to safe and affordable services and thereby integrates social inclusion in sustainable transport. Governments and multilateral institutions, such as the World Bank, are actively investing in solutions to ensure that the transition from conventional internal combustion engine to electric mobility go hand in hand with socially inclusive development goals. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Shunya podcast, a series where we interview India's sustainability leaders. In today's episode, we have with us Gerald Olivier, who is a lead transport specialist India with the World Bank. He focuses on developing solutions to enhance urban mobility, achieve sustainable economic integration through multimodal transport, enhance rural connectivity, and achieve safer transport to better serve the needs of India. He leads the bank's community of practice on transit-oriented development. He focuses on developing solutions to enhance urban mobility, achieve sustainable economic integration through multimodal transport, enhance rural connectivity, and achieve safer transport to better serve the needs of India.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Shunya podcast. My name is Randeep Singh, and on today's episode, we have with us Mr. Gerald Olivier. Since joining the World Bank in October 1995, he has developed sustainable transport infrastructure and services in 17 World Bank member countries through projects, knowledge sharing, technical assistance, and capacity building. Gerald has led teams that prepared and supported urban transport projects, port management and development, public-private sector participation, port city urban renewal, transport corridor developments, trade and transport facilitation, and rural roads. Welcome, Gerald, and thank you for taking the time to chat with us.
Thank you very much, Randeer. It's great to be with you and with all the listeners of the podcast.
Thank you, Gerald. And we'll start with some of the personal questions. We want to drill you with some personal questions. So you have been in the space of international development for nearly three decades. What made you choose this path?
Well, you know, it really started during my engineering degree. I had the opportunity to work and live in Vietnam and in Korea. And as I went through that, you know, as an engineer, I love finding solutions to complex problems. And nothing gets more complex than working in a country that is not your own and trying to understand the context and formulate solutions. So, you know, the more you get exposed to new countries, the more solutions emerge and the more it gets exciting. So that, you know, I started for, you know, working for the World Bank for 1 year, and then I'm still there 27 years later, still very much enjoying what I do.
So which country actually excited you most, or I should say, challenged you most in terms of the work?
Oh, that's a very good question. Actually, I did work in 30 countries or so, and I did live in a few of them. USA was quite interesting in the sense of a country where things were moving quite, you know, well, were well organized. China was fascinating by the pace at which things were occurring. You know, in a few years, you would deliver massive program. Singapore, where I lived also, was absolutely amazing in terms of how the transport and land use planning were put together in ways that really delivered quality of service for the people in a very structured manner. And last but not least, India is one of the most fascinating of all, given the scale of a challenge, the opportunities that exist, and the vibrancy of the many people I've had the chance to work with.
That's great. 27 years, 30 plus countries. So it's quite an international experience. What if I ask your family about how does they take your international movements? What will they say?
That's a good one. I would say that I've been more absent than present in many cases. And that's maybe the drawback that comes with the job. A lot of travel all the time.
True. And I can totally relate it with Thanks, Gerald. Now let's dive deep into the sector specific questions. So again, you have had experience in many countries, developing countries, emerging economies, and developed economies. So what are the critical factors that India should focus to be one of the world leaders in urban mobility, and to be very specific, electric mobility?
Well, first, let's start by saying that India is really at a pivotal moment in terms of what it does in terms of urban mobility. The urbanization that is taking place right now and will take place over the next 3 decades is an opportunity to think differently about how to shape the cities, shape them in ways that foster opportunities for everybody. And that really requires a deep vision of what you see your cities becoming as. And, you know, I had the chance to listen to the first podcast with Mr. Amitabh Kant. And, you know, he really emphasized the opportunity to think differently than what the rest of the world has been pursuing. Because that vision is a vision that can be centered on people, centered on green, resilient, inclusive, and development-focused development, as well as thinking about the safety of the system altogether. So as India moves in that massive urbanization, the land use and transport planning needs to really be integrated. The multimodal development so that door-to-door services are offered to everybody needs to be thought through in ways that is not juxtaposing different systems, but really think about how people are able to move from one place to another through a combination. And, you know, as you go through that process, realize that one of the biggest assets is actually the walking and public space. That's what makes cities vibrant and the like. So, you know, and it benefits everybody as you go through that. Now, looking at the uniqueness of India, I think one of the potential areas of leadership is the leveraging of data. Data is really changing the way people plan and deliver a sustainable mobility solution. It's an opportunity to have a very good understanding of mobility of all groups of people in a disaggregated manner so that the services can be planned better as you move forward. Now, when it comes to electric mobility, I think everybody is conscious today of air pollution, carbon emission, and electric mobility, and I'm sure we'll speak quite a bit about this during this podcast, is really one of the vehicle or opportunity for India to jumpstart and ensure that as many of the new vehicle that come in play are electric. And that requires attention to charging and other aspects that we'll discuss today.
Yes, Gerald. In fact, when I talked to G20 Sherpa, Mr. Amitabh Kant, he emphasized a lot about that even in the working groups for the G20, which are going to come, all the 12 working groups, somewhere or somehow, the topic of climate, climate change, and climate finance is going to be taken care. That means this is a topic which is going to, you know, echo in every hall, in every meeting. So to create a win-win for the climate and development and to ensure the coexistence of development progress. I mean, of course, like an emerging economy like ours, India, that and the achievement of the climate targets, what do you think is required? And in fact, to be very specific, what do you think India is doing right and what India actually needs to do?
So it's a great question, because as you think about a country like India, you're going to see a lot of growth in demand for transport, be it for passenger or for freight. I mean, if you look at, you know, 2070, which is the target for the net zero that was set by India, you're going to have 3 to 5 times more passenger and freight traffic, respectively. So the question is really, how do you think differently about creating the right environment for that growth to take place in ways that is not going to be impacting negatively the urban environment? And that thinking differently requires, you know, systematically looking at opportunities to avoid motorized transport when it's not needed, you know, like creating space that are much more walkable and the like plays a role in urban context. Thinking about solutions where people don't need to move as much for the same kind of end outcome, like e-services and the like, plays a big role as well. The second part is really about a shift that can be promoted towards more shared mobility solution. And that's very much aligned with what the vision of your prime minister has been, to create a vision of shared mobility, connected, and, you know, all the principles that were laid out in 2018 are very much consistent with what this new, you know, coexistence of development and climate targets are about. The next thing that you have an opportunity to work on is that improving the fuel types that are being used to move people around. And that's where, you know, electric mobility, hydrogen, and the like will play a big role as you go through the next few decades of transformation in your system. Now, on all of these, India is undertaking major industrial commitments, you know, trying to foster development of those new industries, creating missions and vision. And the challenge is often, how do you turn those very visionary statements and programs into reality that are going to have an impact on the ground at national, state, and city level? And that requires, you know, an architecture of institutional cooperation that often requires both horizontal and vertical cooperation across many agencies. I mean, as you are in NITI Aayog, you know better than anybody how many agencies need to be consulted on any topic you're working on. And that part is actually the glue that converts a vision into implementation. And that's not easy. And in particular, in a democracy, large democracy like India. So those are elements that are pivotal. I would say the next item that is very critical in that process is to realize that it goes beyond assets. It's about the quality of service delivery that you're offering. So, you know, as you invest in your railroads, you invest in your buses, etc., ultimately, what will make people shift towards those better solution, greener solution, will be the quality of the service that they are being offered across the different solutions. And that is a mindset shift. This is a transformation that is as important, even though it may require less capital, as the asset investment.
Right, Gerald. Bringing everybody on board, doing the stakeholder consultations, getting the buy-in from each and everyone, having diverse views, diverse interests. It's difficult, but definitely it is required, mainly to bring in the transparency to the knowledge and also to gain in, you know, we call about the crowdsourcing, but this is about the sourcing of the knowledge from the crowd. This is what is very, very important, because collectively it actually adds the value. In fact, the other day I was talking to Mr. Ashish Kundra in one of the podcasts, and he was talking about the gender inclusiveness. In fact, they have started the program for, you know, giving training to the women for electric buses. So they started the program also. And you were also the part of the hashtag He Stands For She campaign, which supports women's safe access to transportation. Can you talk more about the need for inclusivity and women's safety element in transportation?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a topic that is really, really dear to my heart. Actually, when you look at the aspiration of a new self-reliant India and the shift from women's development to women-led development, it really requires cities that are going to be designed for all type of users, you know, especially women and girls, gender minorities. And, you know, as we look at this, we can see that often the cities have been designed thinking about the male commuter more than the way women travel in cities. What we find from different studies is they are experiencing cities differently in terms of when they travel, the type of trip they do. A lot of what we call care trips are done by women, where they have to care about a child or an elderly as they go through their trip. A lot of chain trips where they move from one mode to another as they move forward. And because the design have been, the service of transport, public transport have been designed with the male commuter in mind, what is available is not actually coinciding with what they need. So there is a very big opportunity to shift the way the system works to ensure that people can access employment opportunity, education opportunities, cares, and even leisure in ways that give them equal opportunity in the society. We actually just issued last week one of our new publication on, it's a toolkit actually that we designed on enabling gender responsive urban mobility and public space in India. It's a pretty detailed document that looks at the what and how to through 50 case studies, you know, with respect to how to create a more inclusive environment, how to also reduce safety threats that are commonly experienced by women as they go through the urban mobility system. So absolutely central to anything we do in urban mobility, because urban mobility needs to work for everybody. And currently, women have not been really well, you know, captured by the way we design the urban mobility systems.
So, Gerald, you are very well aware and very well involved in the process of the battery swapping. So, you know, India is the first country who has actually come out with a formal draft policy in the public domain for the battery swapping. And you also published one of the articles that titled A Greener Future, Thoughts on India's Proposed Battery Swapping Policy. So, we want to know specifically what are your thoughts about the battery swapping policy draft, as well as where do you see this will succeed segment-wise, area-wise, demographically, because, you know, India is a large country, but with different sets of the population. We have the majority living is still in the rural areas where the, you know, the power connectivity is still an issue. So, how do you see it propagating in India?
Well, I think it's a great question. And I would like to start by congratulating Niti Aayog for leading the agenda on this. I think the market had been asking for quite a while to create an environment where battery swapping would be given an opportunity to grow in the same way as e-mobility does. You know, when you look at the transition towards electric mobility, I think there are a few things maybe to keep in mind before I go to swapping per se, if you don't mind. The first thing is, in particular for 2- and 3-wheelers, over the next decade, India will be adding 150 two-wheelers more or less, 150 million two-wheelers more or less, about 6 million three-wheelers. And if those are purely conventional vehicle, you're locking in 400 million tons of carbon emission. If those are electric, you're able to save, right? So there is a massive opportunity actually to accelerate, you know, the uptake of electric 2- and 3-wheelers. Now, with that segment in mind, swapping plays a very big role, because as we all know, it's not always easy to charge on the street in India. Right. So people, as they look at the vehicle, start thinking about, okay, I'm buying an electric two-wheeler, but where do I charge? If a battery is not removable, it's difficult to charge on the street. That's the first point of concern. The second point of concern is we all know that the cost of a battery can be 40, 50%, 60% of the vehicle, depending on how large a battery is. And for many people today, even though the economics of electric 2- and 3-wheelers work out, you know, over the life cycle of the asset, they are looking for their immediate out-of-pocket cost. So the battery swapping takes away a big chunk of the cost and then allows the user not to see that upfront burden associated with the battery and rather pay it on a regular basis through a fee-based subscription. So it really improves the comparison between 2- and 3-wheeler and can foster the accelerated transition from conventional to electric 2- and 3-wheeler. Now, where does it work best? Well, it will work not for everything. It's not the one-shot silver bullet. It's rather one of the many options that are emerging in the market, but a critical one. It will work well in cities where you have concentration of demand, and therefore you will see more and more of those swapping stations emerging. It will take place most likely as well in areas where there is maybe less concentration of population, but coincide with, you know, freight distribution where, you know, three-wheeler powered by swept batteries could be plying around a you know, a metropolitan region, for example. So many, many opportunities. And I think the swapping policy that Niti Aayog has been drafting really capture this well by thinking about ecosystems. And ecosystems in the sense that there will not be one option, but there will be different use cases. And those ecosystems will be able to provide compatible solutions for those use cases. And as they go forward, that will bring economies of scale and allow essentially the system to be addressing two of the big bottlenecks of the EV transition.
Definitely. We need many, many disruptive solutions for EVs to penetrate in a country like ours. Now, India's CV sector, that is commercial vehicle sector, has primarily progressed financing solutions. And this is true with other segments too. In view of higher upfront cost of the EVs, this becomes even more important. We know that Niti and World Bank is working on proposing the solution for this through first loss risk sharing mechanism, as well as for the charging infra. Can you elaborate that further and give some examples from other countries, maybe a different segment, including India's learning in solar implementation through a similar program? And what's your expectation from this program in terms of climate goals?
So I think it's really interesting to think of it as the challenges associated with the transition today. I mean, if you try to buy a conventional two-wheeler, you go to a bank, you can get a three-year loan, you can cover up to 90% of the value of a vehicle, and you will get a 16% interest rate. If you're looking at an EV, you will have only 2 years of loan maturity. It will cover only 70 to 80% of the value of a vehicle, and maybe not even the replacement of a battery. And then the interest rate will be 5% higher. I mean, of course, it depends on who you are, where you are, but I'm looking at comparable scenarios of a client going to do that. And the same for a three-wheeler. Now, it's very clear that if one cannot convert the high upfront cost of an electric vehicle into something that is spread over time, the penetration of those vehicles is going to be slowed down. And even though we are seeing some initial gain, you know, I think last month 3% of the vehicles were electric in the total sales. So it's a very big improvement compared to a year ago. You're still very far from the, you know, 30-40% that you're aiming at in a few years' time. And here financing will play a big role because people care first and foremost on their out-of-pocket cost associated with a vehicle. How much do I pay each month? So in that context, at the request of Niti, the World Bank has been interacting with the market, with CDB in particular, and working with CDB on trying to elaborate a facility that would unlock access to capital and accelerate the transition by making sure that all of these very innovative NBFCs and the like that are providing new technology-driven solution to accelerate financing of two- and three-wheelers get access to lower-cost financing, but also that those larger institutions that are considering, that are active in the conventional vehicle financing, but they are still cautious about the two- and three-wheeler market, would be entering on a much larger scale that market by providing essentially a de-risking of a loan that they are providing to that market. Now, the idea behind all of this is how do you increase very substantially the level of lending that goes to the sector? I mean, the latest estimate now is that about 28% of e-two-wheelers are being financed by commercial loans. It used to be only 5% 2 years ago. Now it's about 28%. But it's only half of what a regular two-wheeler would be getting. And typically, it's 60% of all the purchase of two-wheelers are receiving finance. So, you know, through a mechanism of this kind, by looking at both fundamental de-risking, by working on, you know, together with Niti and others on seeing the standards and the quality of vehicle improve, on seeing solutions like the swapping come in, on accelerating the access to financing through this kind of risk-sharing facility, we see that there is a very clear link to the experience in the solar panel industry, renewable energy that took place a decade ago, where at the very beginning, when the market emerges, people are still very cautious because there are risks that are not quantifiable. There are perception of risk that may not be fully aligned with the realities, but they are still, the perception is the basis on which a commercial lender will be pricing their loan. So by bringing information, by improving the quality of vehicles that are being screened, by looking at ways to essentially de-risk the entire process, and by providing financial de-risking, we look at helping shift that S-curve of adoption, where initially there's very little demand and suddenly grows very fast, towards the present, as opposed to 3-4 years in the future.
Right, Gerard. And in fact, this increase of 5% to 28% is mainly attributable to two big reasons. Reason number one is that the ease of access to finance has actually increased. That means the financing companies offer very customized solutions to each and every customer, and their reach to these customers have increased. This is one. And the second part is the ticket size has also increased. So earlier, major chunk of the two-wheelers which were selling were in the range of 30 to 50K. And this has now increased 50 plus. So that's why these are the two very, very big reasons that this 5% has increased to 28%. And in fact, as these two factors grow further, we will see this particular 28% rising further. Now, World Bank is actually working in different geographies. In fact, throughout India, you are working. And easing access to sustainable mobility, enhancing the uptake of EVs is one of your primary tasks, or one of the tasks which you have undertaken. Can you share some of the details of a few partnerships and projects that you are most excited about?
Yeah, so I mean, aside from the one I just mentioned, which I think is one of the most exciting engagement we have on the EV as a risk-sharing mechanism, I would say one of the other one is the Chennai City Partnership, where together with the government of Tamil Nadu government, we are supporting the transformation of the thinking around transport and land use planning, helping create new institution or operationalize institutions that existed nominally, but now are being staffed. And for example, the Chennai Urban Metropolitan Transport Authority, which will allow that vision that I was describing earlier to emerge. So that includes looking back at the comprehensive mobility plan, sharpening it, bringing data in the mix, thinking about all types of user categories, and creating demonstration pilots on how to reconfigure the streets or the highways within the city so that they are more resilient to floods and the like, safer. And as you go through that process, you have an opportunity to also think through how the massive investment taking place in mass transit can be further leveraged through transit-oriented development. So this is the kind of thing that you cannot do in one project. You need a series of projects. First one has been approved. We are discussing the next two phases, but these are the kind of deep engagement that allow, working on sustainable mobility comprehensively. And as you go through that, integrate the thinking on electric mobility. Where do you want people to charge? What are the business model associated with that? Is there a need for nudging that and work on the tariff policies and the integration of renewable energy as part of this mix? So that's one. That's the second project I think I would mention. The third one I would mention is we have been quite actively engaged in conversation on the e-bus transformation, also a program very much supported by Niti Aayog that was launched a year and a half ago, succeeded remarkably in terms of achieving low price point through the grand challenge that CESL was conducting. And, is defining a new opportunity actually to rethink about service delivery at scale, green, and for everyone, right? So those are important elements because they show that through innovation in the contracting, through tweaking of the size of the contract, agglomeration economies, and harmonization of demand, a country like India is in a unique position to actually move the needle in ways that smaller countries may not be able to, right? So it creates a leadership role, and, you know, very happy to have been engaged in those conversations and provide some, inputs to the process. But this is just the beginning. There's 1 million buses in India. 5,000 buses is a good start. 50,000 buses is much better. But then the question is, how do you help the million bus transform? And that's the kind of thing that, you know, certainly the government of India has massive opportunity to achieve and show leadership globally on.
That's true. We are actually looking towards that, and somehow at least 50% of that 1 million buses will happen soon. The Shunya Zero Pollution Mobility Campaign actually aims to increase the adoption of EVs in the last mile delivery and ride-hailing sector in India by creating consumer awareness. Now, you know, the financing is one part which is actually an issue with all the sectors when we talk about the transformation of this ICE to EVs. It also includes the aggregators, which are working towards the last mile delivery and the ride hailing sector, including the gig workers. How do you think the first loss sharing mechanism can help these two sectors specifically?
Well, I would say they are our primary targets, right? Because the risk sharing facility is really trying to convert an economic opportunity into a financial reality. When you think of it, those are vehicles that are used more than 50 kilometers a day, often 80, 90, 100. And we know that the economic threshold where it makes sense to shift is around, you know, depending on the vehicle, 60 to 80. So they fit right in terms of the economic viability. And then the question is, how do you convert it into an out-of-pocket cost advantage? That's where, you know, maturity needs to be longer, interest rate needs to be lower, loan-to-value ratio needs to be increased. And when you combine all of these three parameters, you can achieve those by de-risking the product so that banks are more willing to be flexible on those three parameters. So if I think about where the EV resharing program is going to be the most effective, it's going to be on those segments you just mentioned, which have been primed in many ways during the COVID crisis by people ordering more and more online. We also see a lot of aggregators coming in and trying to bring economies of scale, a little bit like what I was describing in the context of e-buses just before. And those would be able to access the facility. Leasing company would also be able to access the facility. So all of these together, I think, tick the boxes in terms of advancing that e-mobility agenda in areas where the economics are sound and you know, seeing results on the ground.
Definitely. Seeing results on the ground is something which is very important. And this is something for each and every program we have to aim to. Now we are entering into the last part of our podcast. It's a rapid charge round and short answers, one-line answers is what we expect. So apart from your current role and responsibilities, could you share any one action you take towards combating climate change on a more personal level?
Yes, I commute by public transport.
Oh, that's great. So what is the easiest part of your job?
I think finding fulfillment in what I do, because if done well, it can impact a lot of people. So fulfillment is the easiest part of my job.
Are you reading something currently?
Yes. An interesting book called Prisoner of Geography by Tim Marshall that looks at how the particularities of countries in terms of geography impact its long-term development.
Now, I mean, some of our listeners may want to hear this also from you. For someone looking to start a career in international development and climate change, what are the three key skill sets that the person needs to develop?
Well, there are many, but I think if I were to narrow it down to three, I would say listen, because it's not your context, so you need to understand before you propose something. Second, manage complexity. Problems are not unidimensional any longer. You need to manage complexity. And third, to be relevant, you need to have an appetite to share. And, you know, those three can go quite a long way in terms of starting a career and continuing it because you like it.
Great. And whenever you are in India, where the people can find you if you're not in your job?
I'm difficult to trace. I tend to travel quite a bit around India. So you would find me most likely either in Chennai, Mumbai, or Delhi.
Perfect. Now, the final one. How can the listeners of the podcast contribute to Shunya Pollution Future for India?
So I think when it comes to Shunya Pollution Future for India, everybody has a big role to play. It starts with, you know, little habits, but it's also about how do we start rethinking what the future can look like and acting upon that to steer it in the right direction. A lot of changes of this kind require, you know, deep rethinking, and that comes from the grounds up. You know, if we cannot just look at the old models and say, this is what we have to do. And that takes all of us to keep being a thought leader at our own level.
Thank you, Gerald. And thank you very much for joining us today on this podcast. Your thoughts are very, very important. And we see we connect further for different programs and in different geographies within our country also. The financing sector is the one definitely most important for EVs to take off really well. Thank you very much. Thank you for having us.
Randy, it was really a pleasure. It's always good to speak with you. I enjoyed the talk. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to the Shunya podcast. We will be back again next week with another episode. Till then, take care and join our Shunya Ka Safar aimed at reducing air pollution by electrifying transportation in India. Visit www.shunya.info to know more about the campaign.